Before I start, I'd like to recognize my collaborators. Keigo Fukumura has done most of the work that I'm going to talk about in collaboration with Hulda Haar, John Kontopoulos, Marcus, and Sean Scully. This work is already out, and it's not really related to blazers, but now with Marcus and Sean Scully, we're looking into applying the same models now to blazers. Oops. Wait a minute. Okay. I got some facts now. As we noted, AGN are multi-scale, multi-frequency objects. We need to understand basically the structure of both the large band in frequency and large scale in R. Since we're looking down the beam, it's very hard to do that, so it's worthwhile to see what we can learn from looking at objects which are at large inclination angles, so we can really probe the structure of the included inclination tori all the way from the central source to the torus. This horus can be done not by non-thermal process, but by looking at X-ray spectroscopy. The nice thing about X-ray spectroscopy is that there are X-ray transitions that basically live in a very, very wide range of ionization parameter. Ionization parameter is the ratio of photons to electrons. So very high, very close to central object, have high ionization, far away, have low ionization. And we've seen in X-ray absorbers ions that span all this wide range, and all that in 1.5 decade in frequency. So that's a very powerful technique in probing the structure across many, many decades in ionization parameter and quite likely in radius. Now, we heard a lot about molecular tori. Those are really impossible objects. They have h over r over 1, implying random velocity is comparable to planar velocity, 3 to 500 kilometers a second. However, the temperature is about 10 to 100 degrees. Thermal velocity is only 1 kilometer. These, therefore, cannot be static objects. Otherwise, they would collide with themselves and hit to that temperature, the kinetic temperature of 500 kilometers. That was noted first by Bigelman and Krolik. So there has to be dynamic objects, namely winds. At distances of parsec where the tori are, the radiation field is very low momentum, so therefore it cannot really be radiatively driven. It has to be magnetically driven. That was proposed a long time ago now by Koenig and Cartier. Here's some X-ray absorption spectra. You have absorption in X-rays both in the quasars, in galactic black holes, that's GR1655-40, in Seyfert's, and in radio galaxies. You can see the detail that you can see in X-ray spectroscopy. Of course, that's not in all objects, but those are kind of rather specific objects I'm showing here. The hope here is that we'll be able to understand all this X-ray spectroscopy, plus all the blazer phenomenology with a small number of parameters. That should be our goal, as Paolo pointed out this morning. And Borison is the, as far as to my knowledge, that really made this kind of diagram with trying to fit basically the entire AGN population with two parameters, M dot and L over lambda. The reason we hope that this is possible is because the accretion of winds, any astrophysical flaws in general related to compact objects, they are invariant. I mean, they have, that is, independent of the mass of the gyrating object, of the gravitating object, if the mass flux is expressed in units of the Eddington mass flux, that's the little m dot I will refer to in the rest of the talk. M dot Eddington is the Eddington multiplied by C squared. The radius in terms of the Schwarzschild radius and the velocity circularity. Once we do that, then what really breaks the symmetry is actually radiative processes like dust emission that doesn't scale this way, black body emission also doesn't scale that way, self-absorption. So the whole idea is to try to have some underlying scale invariant flow and break the symmetry depending on the size or the mass of the object with other processes. Well, let's continue here. As I mentioned earlier, these objects that we call this fission we call absorbers, they have ions in a very wide range of C, in ionization parameter, that's called C. And what Bihar and collaborators did, they decided that in order to get some feeling of what is the structure of these objects, they should basically try to see what is the column density of every ion as a function of per decade of C. What they found, to my surprise, and I hope to their surprise, is that the column density is roughly independent of C. There's some small dependence on other objects, but it's not really very, very steep dependence, much, much less, much less steeper than if you were expecting to radiate with different winds. Let's just say a quick estimate here. C is L over NR squared. Take 1 power of R into N becomes column density. So for the column density, it becomes L over CR. And we found out that you form the EN E log C, that's also L over CR. That is constant, it means C goes like 1 on R, which means the density goes like 1 on R. These are not radiatically driven winds. They're actually magnetically driven winds. Laffer Payne was the first ones to basically look into this type of wind. We'll concentrate more on solutions done by Kondopoulos and Loveless. I don't want to bother you with the details. You write all the equations down in axisymmetry, you try to solve them, you look for solutions that variables separate. So you have basically powers in R and functions of theta. After you put all your integrals of motion, you're left with one equation. That's the force balance in the theta direction. That's called the Grassof-Rhamhoff equation. And it looks like it's like a wind equation. Once you pass, you have to pass the critical point. And once you do that, then you have the solution, the complete solution of the wind. S is something you choose. So Blafford and Payne chosen S equals 3/2. We've chosen S equals 1 simply because that's what the observation indicate. Once you do that choice, you have that choice, and you calculate the mass loss. The mass loss goes like X, which is dimensionless radius, to the S minus S plus 3/2. We see that S has to be equal to 1 from observations, which means M dot has to be X to 1/2. That means that the mass flux of these winds, whatever they are, hopefully they're the same in blazars, increases with distance. Or rather, most of the accretive mass cannot make it to the black hole, peels off into the wind. So the only tiny fraction next to the central source. And indeed, there's mounting observational evidence that the mass flux at larger distances is much, much higher than what we need to power the black hole. You can calculate the ionization of these winds. We have to basically assume something about the luminosity. The luminosity can be either proportional to m dot or to m dot squared if you're in the ADAF regime. The interesting thing is that for s equals to 1, c goes like 1 on r. So basically, what we have then with these winds, very near the black hole, very high ionization. As you go farther and farther out, you have lower ionization. So, and what does the density look like? Well, here's the density as a function of theta now. It drops like 1 on r along any radial direction, but has a theta dependence, and it's a pretty much a power law, an exponential. It's very, very low column density along the theta. The theta equals 0, about 10 to the 3 to the 4 times larger column in the equatorial direction. This wind is the unification torus. It turns out that Fischer et al. Found that that's the fit to the data they try to disentangle. It's very, very close to this line up to that point. A few things about the wind. The wind starts as a toroidal wind, moves in the toroidal direction as it goes to higher, larger latitudes, becomes more and more poloidal. The velocity starts very, very small in the z direction and becomes asymptotically radially out. And of course, the toroidal velocity drops as you go farther out to conserve angular momentum. This is the density profile in color done by Keigo Fukumura. I'll skip that. We don't do that. And now this venerable picture from this version closer to much less sexy one, this one. But now we know that we have material all the way from the near the black hole all the way to the what you call the torus. This material is not actually random material, but has a very, very well-defined property, namely a density profile that goes like 1 on R, becomes less and less ionized as you go farther out. It goes sufficiently farther out, and it becomes cool enough that the its temperature is below the dust sublimation temperature, becomes molecular, that's the torus. It flows outward like everything else. Of course, there's an edge to the torus with an edge to the disk. Now, because the density profile drops like 1 on R, at every decade we have equal probability of scattering the central source photons through all directions, and once you do that, you can calculate how many photons you have along the jet axis by simply by integrating the emissivity along this line. Now, we have done the photonization of the entire wind. However, in the next few minutes, I'll give you some estimates of pure scattering because that's easy to deal with. So for pure scattering, then you can simply calculate the luminosity of every point. It's L over 4 pi r squared times the optical depth, which is tau of r. And then you can, but tau is constant per decade of r. And now you can basically integrate all the contribution to the so-called blob there. Because those field lines are parabolic, then you can relate the radial direction to the distance d by this relation. We can easily, I think I go back instead of going forward. The photon density becomes proportional to m dot squared because in the ADF regime, we assume that at some point where in the ADF regime, the luminosity goes like m dot squared. This m dot squared over d squared sine, times the sine squared theta over 2 times tau, but tau is proportional to m dot. So effectively, the photon density in the inertial frame goes like m dot cubed times sine to the 4. The magnetic field is a different story, though. The magnetic field doesn't know anything about radiation. All it knows about density. We assume it's a partition on the equatorial plane. So the toroidal field goes like m dot 1 half over the cylindrical distance. And as the cylindrical distance changes, that changes the field. What we're really interested in is the square of the magnetic field. And that goes like m dot square tangent theta over d square. So these two have roughly the same scale, except for that has m dot cubed, and this one has m dot squared. So if as long as m dot is smaller than 1 over gamma, then even if you blue shift that into the rest frame of the globe, the magnetic field will be dominant. So presumably, with one parameter here, m dot over m dot Eddington, we can go from FSRQs to VLIs. Now, Paolo gave me the idea to look at line emission in this case. This is from Osterberg's book. That's the H alpha emissivity versus volumetric luminosity. I can calculate the H alpha emissivity because I know the recombination coefficient times the emission measure for this particular density profile, the wind density profile, and after all is done, is proportional 10 to the 44 times m dot square m9 for 10 to the 9 solar mass black hole. The new L nu is 10 to the 47 m dot square m9. So what you find is that basically both the line emissivity and the volumetric luminosity in the ADF regime, they scale the same way. So here's has the linear relation. Maybe Paolo will let me know if lasers, the VLUX actually are in this line. Check that. If they're not, that means that the line emission of VLX decreases much faster than the luminosity, and which means that in this model that the S, the value of S, the density profile may actually not be equal to 1, but maybe something steeper, like the Blanford-Payne wing, to get this normalization right, they had to integrate all the way to 10 to the 6 Schwarzschild radii. If that wind was actually minus 3 halves, then I would not have this factor of 10 to the 6, so I could have basically very, very little line with very little luminosity. So it's important to check whether VLX actually are on this particular line. You can do the same thing for infrared emission. Take this wing, look from above. That's this calculation there. That's not PLX. Those are not blazers, of course. Those are standard quasars. Nonetheless, because you have this profile intercepts equal amount of luminosity per decade, but emits it in different temperatures, and therefore the infrared, the far infrared spectrum should be flat. Here's some spectra from Mike from Robinson. They're not all that off. And finally, we want to know something about acceleration. Now, I don't have anything to say about acceleration lasers, but I can say a few things about acceleration pulsars. This is the calculation of an ideal MHD pulsar solution, the magnetosphere. Ideal MHD means that the electric field is always perpendicular to the magnetic field. There's no acceleration in the system. However, if you try to, after you find the solution, you find out this, the color gives you the ratio J over rho C. You find out that the electrons fly, they flow out this way, has to come back that way. However, there's a line along the open field lines where the charge has to change sign. That's not consistent with the charge conservation. We must have a source of charge here. Why am I showing that? I'm showing that to indicate that even in the pulsars, even though we try to as hard as we can to put ideal MHD, all of a sudden the boundary conditions force us away from ideal MHD. So when you're about a parsec or 10 parsecs away from the central engine and you have your magnetic fields that do God knows what, I don't know what the local boundary conditions impose onto the pyroelectric fields or not, or the present pyroelectric fields or not. So here's my conclusions. AJ unification models that can accommodate the X-ray absorber properties provide new insights into the Fermi blazar observations. This particularly this 1 over r density profile implied by the absorption measure distribution, that is the X-ray spectroscopy analysis, gives the possibility of external photons along the jet axis, which through scattering along, which is consistent with observations, suggests that low values of M dot are associated with no thermal emission dominated by SSC and LMEC. The model relates the wind characteristics, outer radius and source of IR properties, and also to line properties, which in turn may all be integrated, hopefully, into a single edifice for not only blazers, but all line AGM. Thanks. No, they're very loud. It's a 1 over r profile, and then the velocity of the velocity of the clouds or whatever it is, the flow of the gas is effectively, once you leave the disk, it's radial outward. So that's the velocity field. Now, talking about the M dot. M dot is huge M dots. The M dots are huge. Yes, because the M dot goes like X to the 1/2. Yes.
So we haven't
okay, well then obviously it's a distribution. Yes. Well, I mean, well, obviously we're not done with this yet. This is only, so far what we've done is the photoionization of the wind without the dust and the calculation absorption, X-ray absorption profiles, and we're in the process of calculating H-beta profiles and H-beta luminosities, and of course whatever other emission lines there are, just from the simple wind. Now, this wind may actually be clouds because we have the two-phase stability. Two-phase stability should be, of course, only inside at lower latitudes, because in order to make the stability, you have to be in pressure equilibrium rather than in constant density. So once you have the wind flowing out, you don't have any more the phase stability. The density is given. In order to have the two-phase stability, you have to have the pressure given. So you have to be at low latitudes where the gas pressure is important. So I don't know if the chairman here will allow us to continue.
No. You can close and you can continue.
Yes.
After. Thank you again.